This is the Happy Rant Sports Podcast, in which Ted Kluck and Barnabas Piper rant about old sports, new sports, sports books, sports movies, and anything else related to sports that they feel like. Enjoy.
Hey, welcome to the Happy Rant Sports Podcast. I'm Ted Kluck, joined as always by Barnabas Piper. And Pipe, we need some sports talk today because we are currently in the midst of another Tennessee-like monsoon season. So the ground is perpetually muddy, and we need to think about happier things. And those things include indoor sports like the NBA. Mm-hmm. We'll talk a little NBA today, and we'll talk
Anything with a controlled climate and no rain is right up my alley right now.
Dude, absolutely. Anything where you're not getting wet outside I think would be amazing. And then we're going to talk about some ideal venues or events that we would want to go to as sports fans. But before we do that, let's tell the people about some products and events that they can be involved in with us. So as always, we are promoting Lagaris Roasters Coffee. If you go to happyrantpodcast.com, you can enjoy Happy Rant Sports with a hot cup of Lagaris Roasters Coffee. It is the best coffee I've ever had, and I know you'll feel the same if you try a bag of their coffee. And Pipe, we are rapidly approaching Live in Louisville, too. So let's tell the folks about that. How can they get involved in that one?
If you hear noise in the background, that's because I'm recording near where my dog decided that she was going to play with all of her toys at once. So this is just nice. We're inviting the fans.
Dude,
into
it's raw.
The studio
it's
with us. That's right. That's so right. Just like Ted occasionally gets interrupted by students or phone calls, I'm now being interrupted by a 9-month-old husky mix. That's right. Yeah, granola bars, who knows what. So what did you ask me to promo? Live in Louisville?
Was that Live in Louisville. All right. Yeah.
It's coming up soon. It feels like it's a long way off still because we've been talking about it for so long. But if the fans are anything like me, they looked at a calendar recently and realized like April is less than a month away at this point, which means that Live in Louisville is about a month away. And that's crazy. But there's still time to get tickets. We still have some available. If you go to happyrantpodcast.com, you can find them there. If you are a Patreon supporter of ours, you actually get a free ticket. So there's still a financial investment, but you're supporting the podcast and you get to show up to that for free. All of that can be found at Happy Rant Podcast. It's April 10th is the event. It'll be from 8 to about 11. We will do live recordings. We will do Q&A with listeners. So come with questions ready. Not goofy theological questions. That's really our speed. Good questions. Funny questions. Actually, that's risky because when people try to be funny, often they're lame. But, you know, do your best. You know, bring your best fastball. That's what we want.
Dude, I feel like the best question at the last Live in Louisville came from like an 11-year-old kid. Do you remember that?
Yeah, he asked for advice about like
being 11, basically.
Yeah, he was like, I'm 11 and I want to – I think – what did he say? He said, I think I want to go into missions or ministry. What do I need to be doing now? Like, this is an 11-year-old who's way better than I was at 11. And so he
– way better than I am now, basically.
Right, yeah. I'm like, still not thinking about what I need to
be. Enjoy being 11? I don't know. I would switch spots with him in a heartbeat.
Yeah, his parents deserved major kudos. And then we had somebody else who was like, will there be spicy food in heaven? And I was like, this is I mean, I guess it's stump the chump at this point. I'm not really sure. But this is the breadth of things that happen along with sheet cake and candy and all sorts of goodness. So,
and I can tell you what other goodness there will be at Live in Louisville, too. They're going to be Nerf footballs with our logo. Yes. Happy Rant Nerf footballs. I've seen them. I know that they're going to be there.
They're real, and this makes me spectacular.
Yeah, they're real and they're spectacular. This makes me so happy, Piper. I can't even.
We've got a couple sponsors, which means there will be giveaways. So, and like nice giveaways, not like crappy, systematic theology, PDF handout giveaways. Yeah. Like really
giveaways.
Nice things that you can either use and love or like sell on eBay for actual dollars. So
things that you can get signed by us. I feel like I signed like a couple of other people's books at our last Live in Louisville. But the guy was just like, I want your signature.
I'm happy to sign anybody's books. Bring Jared C. Wilson's books. Bring Joe Thorne's books. Bring so I'll sign them.
Bring other people's books for us to sign.
Yeah.
This is a thing. Nothing would make me happier. I want to autograph someone else's book and in doing so lower the value of it.
Or raise the value of it, depending on the book
value.
Yeah.
Absolutely, man. Absolutely. Well, Pipe, speaking of value and speaking of weird things, we've got some stuff to get into, man. And this topic I love because it involves the NBA, and it also involves like vintage stuff. So I love looking back at these sports. I love coming up with these old names and people we haven't thought about in years. But the question was, who had the weirdest like NBA free throw shooting ticks? And as the years go by, as you watch these games and these players, it seems like there's always a couple of guys in the league who have a super weird form when it comes to free throw shooting, and these guys are memorable. So Pipe, lay one of those on me now. We'll kind of go back and forth here.
Yeah, I have a handful of things down. So there was guys with weird form, and then there was just guys who did weird things at the
like the pre-free throw yes. kind of ritual. Yeah.
So I think the one that stands out of my mind is just a really weird thing. His form wasn't weird, but Nick Van Exel, remember the lefty point guard played for the Lakers?
Super weird looking guy.
Yeah.
Kind of looked like an alien.
A little bit. Yeah. He was like Sam Cassell, but not quite so alien.
Yeah.
But he used to shoot free throws from like a foot and a half or 2 feet behind the line. So, you know, most guys put their toe right at the line. You know, they square up, they centered up. He'd be like a foot and a half behind the line. So instead of a 15-foot free throw, it was like a 17-foot jumper or something. And I think it was just like – I think he just struggled with the mid-range or something. So this was like – this was where he could lock in. And I just thought it was the weirdest thing because it felt like making a relatively simple, easy thing more difficult.
That is super funny. Yeah, like I'm gonna just make it harder for myself. I'm just going to back up a little bit. That's a great one. My first two are both Chicago Bulls, but I'll lay the kind of modern era one on you now. Joakim Noah, do you remember his free throw form?
I remember any time he attempted to get the basketball towards the hoop. It was an adventure of modern art.
His form was sort of like, you know how when you're in grade school and you're in like third or fourth grade and you really want to shoot baskets on a 10-foot hoop, but you don't really have the strength to like to get off a real shot.
It's like a shot put.
Yeah, you kind of push the ball toward the hoop. You start at your chest and it's like a chest pass, but it's toward the hoop.
Yeah.
That to me is what Joakim Noah's free throw form looked like.
Complete with like the you know, like when you snap a chest pass, your hands like the wrist snaps outward.
Yeah.
You know, that's like – whereas when you shoot – the wrist is supposed to be – it's like a gooseneck. It's supposed to snap down.
Exactly.
And his wrist would snap out to the right. Like it was a full twist to the right. And then his left hand was still up there because he shot two-handed, which no NBA players do besides him apparently.
Dude, it was insane. So Michael Rapaport, one of my other favorite podcasters, says – I think he coined this joke. He calls Joakim Noah the world's greatest – women's basketball player. And
I used to make the same joke until I got a little bit convicted that maybe it was sexist.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's probably wrong on a lot of levels, but I think in terms of free throw form, it's apropos. So Piper, lay your next one on me.
All right. The next one I had was Anthony Mason.
Okay.
So you remember
Anthony
Mason?
That name, and I love the era.
Yeah. So 90s Knicks, bruising power forward. Had the crazy eyes, always had a really sweet haircut because it was the era when NBA players were they had designs in their hair much more than they do
designs
now.
In their hair, and it was the era of like the razor cut part for black guys, like not the hipster kind though, like just the little like nick in the front of the hairline. It was so sick, man. I loved that.
Yeah, and I think we talked about this the last sports podcast, maybe it was when we talked about the Black Panther, when we were discussing how we always felt like black people were cooler than us,
wishing we looked like black
guys. This is part of that. They were just cooler, like especially because that was like the era of Rick Smits, and you're like, that's the white NBA player, and then you got Anthony Mason on the other side. Clearly one of these is cooler than the other.
Detlef Schrempf, Chris Mullin, who was a white NBA player.
There's a lot of flat tops and mullets and just like bedhead, and you're like, what are you guys doing?
Yeah, it's like you guys don't even look in the mirror before you leave the locker room. These white guys in the NBA in the 80s and 90s.
And not to be fair, in today's game, there's a lot of like styled haircuts, like the Gordon Hayward and whatever. And you're like, you tried too hard. Like there's 47 pounds of whatever product you use in your hair, so that it never moves during the game. Like not to be
like gay or whatever. Gordon Hayward is a golden god, dude.
I know we've discussed this before.
We've discussed it. If it was 1,000 years ago, he'd be running the world. He literally would run the entire planet. But I digress.
Anyway, enough about Ted's homoerotic tendencies. Anthony Mason was he had this weird hesitation in his shot where he would like go up, you know, and most of the time it's like a smooth motion just up and through, and he would stop at like the peak right before he you know, he went forward into the release. And it, I'm not even sure it was legal, but they never stopped him. And because what it would do is get guys to have lane violations. They would jump in. So he'd like go up, pause for half a beat, and then flick his shot. The other thing was he wasn't a great free throw shooter. So you kind of wonder if he could have done better.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I love the guys with like the neurotic, like jerky ticks in their free throw form. Cause it just looks, it's like you're watching someone be miserable. You know what I mean? You're watching them be hesitant and unsure of themselves. And yeah, that was a great one. Here's one from like an era before that, kind of an era before that, but kind of overlapped with Anthony Mason. Bill Cartwright, another Chicago Bull. Do you remember this free throw form, Piper?
Yes, Cartwright was on my list. He and Robert Parrish both, actually.
Yeah, they kind of had the same issue. Yep. But Cartwright would like fully extend his long arms such that, you know, his the top of his hand was at like 9 feet. So he would fully extend and then pause and then kind of flick the basketball toward the hoop. It was amazing.
Yeah, and I think Cartwright also, because he did that, so it was like his arms were fully extended. But I think he also put like his support hand, so his left hand, in front of the basketball.
Yeah, so yeah, it was really strange.
Or maybe that was David Robinson kind of did the same thing on his jump shot. I mean, that might just be because their hands are so big, they sort of wrap around the ball. But like, so instead of it being on the side of the ball, it was like in front of it, and then he had to like lift it out of the way and shoot with his other hand. It just, the whole thing looked awkward. Not Joakim Noah level awkward, but decidedly not smooth.
You know what I love about Bill Cartwright? Two things. One, he harkens back, and I know we've talked about this before, to an era in which NBA centers weren't athletic.
Yes.
They were just big. They were merely big. And another thing, sub thing I love about that and about Bill Cartwright, like unathletic black guys are fascinating to me because you expect a certain thing, and Cartwright kind of took you the other way. So hats off to Bill Cartwright for both of those fascinating things.
Yes. The unathletic black guy thing is an interesting one, again, because of the expectation slash stereotype that.
Dude, but we were so conditioned as kids in that era to expect, number one, cool looking, and number two, athletic. And Cartwright was kind of neither. You know what I mean?
Yeah, he was definitely not cool looking. I mean, he just looked like a very average man. Like he had just sort of a friendly face, and like he would have been a great like school principal. Like that, he had that kind of face. Yeah.
Yeah. Good goatee, normal looking guy, you know, perfectly normal looking guy.
He looked like a professional athlete.
Yes. He looked like he could have been a lawyer, a doctor, a school teacher, what have you, pick a profession, but looked up just the tiniest bit out of place in the economy of like the trying to look cool 90s NBA, you know, where guys were like carving designs into their hair, as you mentioned before.
Yes, indeed. So I had one more. I don't know how many, you might have a list of like 42. I only had one more on my list.
I got a couple more.
And one was Jeff Hornacek. Mm. So Jeff,
dude, Hornacek, speaking of uncool looking people.
Yes.
This is a great one.
Yeah. The perpetual like Algebra 1 teacher look. Now, Hornacek was actually a really good player and a good shooter. Good, but he did this weird thing before every shot where he would, I think it was, what I understand it to be was like a greeting to his family who was watching on TV. He would rub his cheek with one hand, as part of, you know, so guys are like three dribbles, shoot. He was like three dribbles, rub cheek, shoot.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, But it wasn't like a tap the chin or anything like that. It was like a petting of his own face.
Fascinating. So
it was mildly uncomfortable to watch. So it was like he would caress his face before shooting free throws, and it always captivated.
I don't want to watch anyone caress their own face.
Yeah,
you know, it's very intimate.
No, like stroke your chin thoughtfully, or like. You know, slick your eyebrows or something.
You can like kind of rub your brow, in a furrowed brow. I'm stressed kind of way, but
yeah. But like the petting, the caressing was just, it was an odd thing, and it always stood out as just this like not quite heebie-jeebie level weird, but just sort of mildly uncomfortable.
Absolutely. No, I totally agree. I've got a couple. Let's call these honorable mention, Pipe, and we can just zip through them quickly, and you can chime in on these. Remember Jerry Stackhouse?
I mean, I remember Jerry Stackhouse, the player. I'm struggling to remember his free throw form.
Jerry Stackhouse was in the – I'll put him in the genre of, like, counterfeit next Jordans. Mm-hmm. Remember when everyone was trying to christen their next Jordan and Jerry Stackhouse was one of them and Harold Miner?
Yeah, well, and Stackhouse is made worse because he came from North Carolina, which is Jordan's alma mater too. So he's a 6'6 athletic guy from the same school.
6'6 athletic guy from North Carolina. You're going to get, you know, saddled with the next Michael Jordan thing. But Stackhouse, he would go into like a deep squat. Like a deep, yes, lower than parallel squat before he would shoot a free throw.
Like doing a wall sit. Or
doing
like
a wall sit, or like, you know, going to the bathroom in the woods on a camping trip or whatever.
Like popping a squat.
Yeah, he would get down there, man. He would get right down there and then come all the way up and then shoot the free throw. It was fascinating.
I do remember that now that you describe it. Like my mental imagery is clicking again.
Marcus Camby had a weird free throw form. He had kind of the roundabout. Like he would bring the arms around to the side.
To the left side and then back up to the middle. And he was another one who was like – he was built sort of like the Robert Parrish, where he was like long, lean, athletic, but he was all limbs. And so kind of – even though he was a extremely good athlete, everything he did looked gawky.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, where would you put Marcus Camby in the economy of like cool looking 90s NBA black guys? Where does he rank for you? Does he make like starter, bench guy, or D league as far as being cool looking?
I mean, he'd be like deep bench.
Yeah.
He was more like just a fascinating body type. It wasn't like Larry Johnson, Anthony Mason. These guys are more like that's starter level cool, like in very 90s. Yeah. Like Camby wasn't that. He was just like, you looked at him and you're like, he's not proportioned like any other human being.
Exactly. Yeah. Everything was just a little bit off. Dude, anybody who played for UNLV in college in like the late 80s, early 90s, was exceedingly cool looking.
Yes. Well, yeah. I mean, and Georgetown. You know, that mid to late 90s Georgetown era. Now, it had to be like – it was starting with Alonzo Mourning and after. Like before that, you had like Ewing and whoever, Dikembe Mutombo, et cetera. Yeah. And like those guys were not cool. But
no. Dude, what did you think of the Georgetown aesthetic? I mean, the uniform itself is super dope.
Yeah.
And I would throw hands with anyone who pushed back on that. But like – in the late 80s, you might be a little young for this, but they would always wear t-shirts under their jerseys. Do you remember this?
That was like a thing for an era. I remember like Ray Allen always did that in college too, and he was UConn. Yep. But like there was just an era where like baggy t-shirts were the thing.
Yeah, and it was like they were real t-shirts. It was before all this goofy Under Armour lingerie.
We're talking like beefy tees, not
like Hanes white t-shirts would go under the jersey, and it was for Georgetown, it was a uniform thing. Like everybody did it, and I thought it was I just thought it was kind of a clean look.
That just falls in the era of fashion, along with like, you know, there's like JNCO's jeans, there's the belt chains, there's like in you know, guys in the hood who would wear the shirt, the sleeves off of one shoulder. Like there's just these things that you look back on, you're like, oh, you can peg that within a year.
Absolutely.
Of that era. And it just, that was, I never understood it. I always hated the t-shirt under jersey. To me, that like a t-shirt under a jersey is like when people wear t-shirts to go swimming. Like they're trying to hide something. They're
right. It's a little weird. Like there's always the one guy at the pool party who like keeps his t-shirt on. And it just makes you more intrigued.
I know. You're like, everybody's seeing a big belly. Like,
Everybody here looks gross. You know, none of us look good.
Yeah, unless you have like an ex-girlfriend name tattooed on your chest that you're hiding. Like, the rest of us are like, well, it's not. Yeah, we're not Adonises. So, you know, just be normal.
Absolutely. Dude, should we save – because I'm really tempted here to, again, go off script and go into a like a full-on discussion of coolest looking 90s NBA – white guy and black guy. But I feel like that almost deserves its own program. You know what I mean?
I think we save that one because it's really good. And I also would like to do a little bit, you know, like 8 minutes of thinking before the episode.
Dude, right. Yeah. I don't want to have the show happen and then get off the air and go, ah, I forgot about.
I would also like to go into a Google image wormhole of 90s basketball players. And I can't
do
that right now.
Yeah. That wormhole would be super, super pleasant to go down for sure. Pipe, another topic though, and this was a great one. What kind of venue or event in sports would you kill to go to? So thinking of all the venues, all the events, you know, everything in the world kind of at our disposal. What are a couple of events that you would really, really like to go to that you haven't had a chance to yet?
Yeah, this is a tricky one for me to answer because I am a fan of Minnesota sports. Like those are the teams that I have a deep investment in, which means like I don't want to go to the World Series. I don't want to go to the Super Bowl. I want to go to the Super Bowl when a Minnesota team plays in it, you know, that kind of thing. So for me, it comes down to historical stadiums.
Sure.
I love classic baseball stadiums. Like I've been to Wrigley many times because I used to live in the Chicago area. I've never been to Fenway. And I'm sad I missed old Yankee Stadium.
Dude, you know, my wife has been to Fenway, but I haven't. How crazy is that? She took like a girls trip to Boston a couple years ago with some friends and they like impromptu went to a game at Fenway and I'm getting like texted pictures from my lady about that and being super jealous about it.
It's like my mom was talking about when she was at Wheaton in the 60s, a Chicago suburb. She's like, yeah, I went with a group of friends to a Cubs game and I think it was against the Giants. And she's just sort of throwing this offhand, which makes sense. She doesn't care about baseball. And I'm doing the math and I'm like, 1965. Cubs Giants. I'm like, that's Ernie Banks versus Willie Mays.
Dude, right. She probably wasn't even looking at the field.
She saw the greatest Cub in history versus one of the top maybe three greatest baseball players in history, and it didn't even register.
Exactly.
And it just those things just make me laugh. But so historical baseball stadiums, I would love to go to every baseball stadium. Like every major league park, I've probably been to 2/3, but there's a lot I haven't been to. So just like that, as a collective venue, I would love to see them all. I think that'd be really fun.
No, it would. It totally would, man. And yeah, I'm with you, Pipe, on any kind of old timey stadium, anything like vintage that's still around.
Are there vintage football stadiums that have this? I feel like football has become like. There are no vintage NBA. It's all either new, like the experience is generic.
The experience is so generic. Yeah,
you know, there used to be, you know, Philly had theirs and Boston had theirs. And I guess Madison Square Garden would be the closest. I would love to see it. I would love to see an event like a big time boxing match in Madison Square Garden would be amazing.
That'd be so dope. Speaking of NBA arenas being distinctive, which they are not anymore. I mean, you had the old Chicago Stadium in Chicago, which was a huge deal. But remember the old Milwaukee Bucks arena in which they didn't have like a normal arena roof? They had like a ceiling. Remember that? And you would watch like Bucks games or see clips of the Bucks and you're looking at that going, it's like a drop ceiling.
Yeah,
you know?
It was like they're playing a game in a convention center exhibit hall almost.
Exactly.
Where it's like it's high enough that the ball's not gonna hit the ceiling, but it wasn't like the big thing with the Jumbotron scoreboard hanging down over the court and whatever else.
Dude, and I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, didn't they have like the rubber floor too for a few years?
Did they have
like a non-standard NBA floor? Somebody's going to have to confirm this, but like I'm almost certain the Bucks of a certain era had the weird like rubber floor.
Fascinating. It's possible. They're one of the weirdest franchises when it comes to like ownership and like their arena, because they're building a new one or just opened a new one, and and the two previous ones are still standing and they all sit right in a row.
Yeah.
So somehow I think Herb Kohl is their owner, or he was.
Yeah.
Somehow, because he's a senator, he finagled public funding for two arenas after the old trash one.
Yeah.
And the old ones are just sitting there. Like downtown Milwaukee is a stadium graveyard.
It's collecting arenas.
Yes.
People will go on like walking tours of Milwaukee's arena history in a few years. You know, you can visit all of them.
That is one of the most depressing things I've heard.
Yeah.
A walking
Isn't it?
Tour of Milwaukee's, because Miller Park is a terrible place to watch a game.
I've never watched a game there.
Well, it's
they have a guy that like slides into a gigantic
Bernie
beer.
Brewer.
It's fantastic.
So, have you ever been to a retractable roof baseball stadium?
Dude, I have. I went to a Blue Jays game in the Sky Dome, which for me, okay, so my nerdery vis-a-vis the Sky Dome runs a couple of layers deep. So there's the Blue Jays, but there's also the Toronto Argos played there for many years. So I was excited to see like the stadium that Rocket Ismail played in as a Toronto Argo. But the night I went, it was kind of cold out, so they kept the roof closed. They didn't do the open roof thing.
See, Toronto's is a little different because I think it opens in like a V shape.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't have quite the same like Milwaukee's feels like a like it's just a bad indoor stadium, even when it's like when it's closed, it's just sort of like big and dull and gray. And Arizona's is the same way. Seattle did theirs really well because they made it feel open when it's open. But like a bad retractable roof stadium is a really terrible baseball watching experience.
Dude, isn't the crappiest indoor stadium currently though the Trop in Tampa?
Oh, yeah. The Trop.
I see the Trop on TV, and it looks like they're trying to save money by like leaving some of the light bulbs off.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Like, hey,
like
catch
the
those
Metrodome
lights.
Metrodome with 40-watt bulbs.
Dude, it's a Metrodome with 40-watt bulbs, and it also like my enduring like memory of the Trop is that it just looks like a place where they were trying to save money. Yes. You know what I mean? Like, you can point out areas in which they're like, you know. Realistically, we're not going to draw more than 35,000 people, so let's just leave some seats out. You know.
And every year, two or three guys hit their catwalks with baseballs. Yeah. Like I was watching a Twins Rays game on TV maybe last year, and Miguel Sano from the Twins hit this shot, and like off the bat, I'm like, that's a 470-foot home run. Nope, hits a catwalk, bounces in short left field. He gets a double out of it, but like they don't even have a – there's not like a ground rule anything there. They're just like, it's in play, I guess.
It's like playing like wiffle ball in your friend's big basement, you know.
Exactly. It's like, you hit the light fixture. too bad.
Too bad. We'll see where you end up, you know. Just keep running. Those are great, man. I think for me, like – ideal events or venues to go to, I would love to see a Tour de France stage.
That was on my list.
Yeah, dude. Wouldn't that be cool?
That would be amazing. My dad and one of my older brothers used to be big cycling fans. Like, they were into road biking and stuff. And so they would have it on every summer. We'd go on vacation, and it would just be, like, on.
Dude, July. Regularly. Every July, man. Yeah. And it was amazing TV coverage. It was like there's this guy, Phil Liggett, is sort of the Keith Jackson of European cycling. So his voice was like so distinctive in that coverage. And yeah, like the Greg LeMond, Laurent Fignon years.
Yeah.
And
yeah, Greg LeMond and Miguel Indurain were the two who were like, they were seminal, like cycling peak athletes when from that era for me.
Absolutely. Yeah. Indurain was such a beast, but I just think like gathering in one of these French hamlets and like lining the roads with these fans that are going crazy, you know, the food and like drink situation would be amazing. I just think that would be a fun time, like beautiful vistas to look at, like even
especially in one of the climbing stages where they're in the mountains. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That would be so nice, man. The other one that was on my list was Odessa Permian High School. This is the high school from Friday Night Lights, from the book and the movie. I would love to take in a game down there, be one of 20,000 people in the stands for a crazy Permian Panthers high school football game. I think that would be a just a cool thing to take in.
I will say, like, I would rather go to a Friday night high school football game just about anywhere than I would most professional sporting events.
Oh, dude, I agree. High school football is so good, man. And you get the – if you time it right, you get the little crisp chill in the air. You get the, like – little bit of haze around the lights, the local PA announcer, you got bands. I mean, there's no crappy, like, you know, top 40 music being piped in. I mean, it's just
except for the halftime when like the high school dance team comes out and they do the mashup of like 10 years ago top 40 stuff.
Exactly. Stuff that they could get for cheap, like rights wise or whatever. But I'm with you, man. High school football is right in that sweet spot for me of just a lot of good things. Nostalgia, you know, plays a huge role in that. But I would love to see Odessa Permian. The last one on my list, and maybe you have more. Do you have more, Piper?
I have one or two more.
Dude, lay them on me. Lay them on me. I would love to go
to the Kentucky Derby.
Ooh.
I don't care.
Oh, that's a good one.
I don't care anything about horse racing. I don't know anything about horse racing. I don't bet on sports with any, like, it doesn't, none of that matters to me. But just as like an Americana experience and a people watching experience, I think it would be, plus it's like, it's just a massive party.
It's a massive party, and it's a weird kind of celebrity thing in that you're not seeing any one genre of celebrities.
No.
Like when you go to the NBA All-Star game, you know kind of what kind of celebrity you're going to see.
And, it's like the top 40 hip hop, a little bit of Hollywood.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I feel like the Kentucky Derby pulls like a random assortment of celebrities. Yes. You know, you're getting a little Tom Brady, Julian Edelman, but you're getting like B-list Hollywood people and
Lots of musicians show up.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe because it's 3 hours north of Nashville. I don't know. But it's – yeah, it just – to me, like, it's not one that I have any interest in going to regularly as far as I know. But that's one that I go – it would be a sort of a bucket list. Again,
for sure.
Well, here's a question. Is horse racing a sport? Like, I don't know if that counts as a sporting event or as, like, a cultural event.
Dude, it's funny, man. So growing up, I was a my parents got me Sports Illustrated from like the day I was born right up until college. So it came every week. And in the 80s, especially the early to mid 80s, Sports Illustrated was more random in terms of what they covered. So they would have these expansive like lifestyle pieces almost on like yachting, like Dennis Conner in the America's Cup. And like, but the Kentucky Derby always got a ton of play in Sports Illustrated. And it was kind of like a high society piece almost, in which, you know, it was, you know, pictures of the ladies in their crazy hats. And so, yeah, I have this almost nostalgic acknowledgement of horse racing as a sport. And I also have like a weird romantic, I don't know, kind of fascination with guys who like go to the track and bet on a horse, and like they've got their like betting slip in one hand and like the daily racing form in the other hand, and they're screaming and like that. To me, I don't know why it has good connotations. I think my grandparents on my dad's side used to go to there was a big like NRA horse racing track in NRA is the gun thing.
What I was going to say, this is not the right time to bring up the NRA.
Dude, no, what am I thinking of? What's the acronym for horse racing?
National Horse Racing Association, which would be NHRA if it's
NHRA. I'm guessing, I feel like that's like a hot rod thing too.
That,
I don't know.
That makes more sense.
But they would go to this track and they would like play a little money on the horses. And I feel like everything my grandparents did on that side of the family was just classy. So
I feel like everything from like my parents and grandparents era when it comes to sports was like, it was classier. There was a lot of like wearing suits to events.
Dude. Yeah. So like, my dad and his dad, my grandpa, they were season ticket holders for the Chicago Blackhawks. And my pops is always telling me like, you had to wear a coat and tie to the game. You know, it was like it was a legit coat and tie, fedora kind of situation. But he would also tell me that they had a gigantic bar there that served hard liquor and everybody smoked. So if you sat in the upper deck, you couldn't see anything after like the second period because there was so much smoke. And also there were all these fights that would break out in, you know, all over the stadium because of the hard liquor that was being served.
Right, and everybody's just lit.
Yeah, everybody's smashed out of their, you know, bombed out of their tree by the third period. So, yeah, my last one, Pipe, was the Blue Horizon, which was a fight venue in Philadelphia.
Okay.
So another nostalgic thing growing up, there was always Friday Night Fights on ESPN.
Mm-hmm.
And Friday Night Fights, about 50% of the time during my childhood, would be from the Blue Horizon in Philly. And the Blue Horizon looked like a weird cross between a theater and a church in that it was old-timey. It was kind of ornate, but the balcony wrapped all the way around the ring on four sides. But if you sat in the balcony, you were almost like over the ring. So you're almost like hanging over the ring. And it was just a small, loud, hot, sweaty, you know, incredible Philly boxing venue. I mean, Philly's like Mecca for boxing anyway. Like if you love that sport, you got to make the pilgrimage and do some boxing stuff in Philly, which I've done, but I've never been able to see a fight at the Blue Horizon. That's one I would like to do.
Yeah, boxing is one that I would love to see live. There's just not like boxing has lost so much of its like identity and luster.
Yeah,
that there's not a seminal thing that happens now. Like in terms of venues, I'm sure if you're heavy into boxing, you would correct me. But it is a pay-per-view sport now.
It is. Yeah, and all
which
the
means
fights
it's mostly in Vegas and things like that.
Dude, it's like the NFL. There's no cool NFL stadiums anymore. I mean, they're all the same. They're all, you know, new bells and whistles and all that nonsense. I mean, there's no cool old stadium.
Like,
but
heavyweight boxing used to like it would pack out Madison Square Garden. They would fight at Yankee Stadium. Like,
dude, they would fight at Yankee Stadium, Soldier Field, Madison Square Garden. It was incredible, dude. The legacy of heavyweight boxing, and even like when we were kids, like the. Like Atlantic City had a real distinctive arena. It had kind of the curved lights that went over the ring, and but now all the fights are at like the MGM Grand, you know, Garden Arena, and I've covered fights there. It's no big thing because it just feels like you're in any other arena in the world. So yeah, man, old timey boxing arenas they've gone the way of old football stadiums with character. So that begs the last question, Pipe. If you could go back in time and go to any venue that's gone now, what venue would it be and for what event?
Oh, man. I mean, the one that comes to mind immediately, and I'm there's a couple reasons for this. One is it is early March, and I'm itching for baseball season. Two is, as mentioned before, Jackie Robinson is a sports hero of mine. I would love to go watch April 15th, 1947, Ebbets Field.
Wow.
I think it was a home game. I think he broke the color barrier at home when Jackie Robinson played his first game in the majors. Because Ebbets Field, if you go back and look at pictures of it, it was one of the iconic baseball stadiums. You know, big brick facade built right into a neighborhood. Think like Fenway, but in Brooklyn. Like it had that feel to it. And then Jackie Robinson and that thing. So I mean that is the first one that comes to mind in terms of just like if I could go to a sporting event at a location, it would be that one.
Oh, that's a great one, man. That's such a good one. I think for me, it would be, and this stadium still technically exists, but it really doesn't exist. The old Soldier Field. So
yeah, the old Soldier Field doesn't exist. It just, it's, yeah. I think they still have the same grass, but
yeah, they still have the same crummy grass, but everything else was like, you know, kind of torn down to the studs and rebuilt. But it just looks like a goofy modern spaceship now. But back in the day, Soldier Field was distinctive. The sight lines sucked. It was very shallow, and it had the old, like, kind of Roman columns around the top. But I would love to have been in the building in 1984 when the Bears played the Saints and Walter Payton broke the all-time NFL career rushing record.
Yeah, that's a good one.
That one, to me, Payton was my guy. He was my hero. Early to mid-80s was like – I was real young, so I still cared, and I cared about heroes, and I cared about teams. And for me, that would have been the kind of seminal Bears moment to be in the building for that one. Great old AstroTurf, old AstroTurf moment, old Soldier Field moment. It was a great uniform game. It was when the Saints had they're wearing their white jerseys with the black pants with like the big thick stripes down the side. It was a good Saints uniform. Just everything about that day would have been pretty right in my mind.
That would be good. Which Muhammad Ali fight would you go to if you could pick?
Such a good question, man. Such a good question. Boy, I tell you, man, I'm gonna have to go with two different ones. One kind of for historical perspective and the other just for a great fight. But I think the first one would be the night in Miami where he beat Sonny Liston for the first time.
So this is that was pre Ali's essentially getting kicked out of boxing for political reasons.
Yeah, way pre that, pre getting kicked out of boxing, really pre name change. I think he was kind of like dabbling with the name change right around that time, but he was still kind of going by Cassius Clay back then. He was young, beautiful, elegant, you know, on the tip of his toes. Like when you see the beautiful old footage of Muhammad Ali fighting in his prime, like this is prime Ali. Very young, very brash, beautiful guy. Angelo Dundee was his trainer. Mm-hmm. I actually got a chance to visit with Angelo Dundee a few years ago before he passed away. That was really cool. But and again, this was when you had fights in different places. So this was in Miami. It wasn't in Vegas. I hate Vegas is my least favorite place on earth. It's such a trashy place. I hate Las Vegas. But like going to Miami for a fight, man, that just sounds like a blast.
Oh, yeah. That sounds amazing.
What about you for Ali fights?
You know, I've read about Ali. I haven't watched a ton of footage other than just highlights. But in what I've read and what I've seen, I would want to see him fight pre – like his most famous fights for the most part are after he came back.
Yeah.
After – you know, so he protested Vietnam, wouldn't go.
Yeah.
They pulled his boxing license and then he came back and fought, and that's when Rumble in the Jungle was and Thrilla in Manila. But those were when he had sort of lost his edge. He was a fighter who could take more punches than the other guy at that point.
Yeah.
I want to see him fight, like the Cassius Clay to Muhammad Ali transition. So Sonny Liston comes to mind. I think the first why am I blanking on it?
Joe Frazier.
Yeah, I was gonna say Joe Lewis, and I'm like, it's not Joe Lewis. Yeah,
dude, those were like, such wars. Those Frazier fights. Any one of those would have been incredible.
The first Frazier fights. You know, first Frazier fight. Like those are the ones that I want to see. Because, I mean, you watch the highlights of him, and I've never seen a faster human being in my life in terms of foot speed and hand speed and just the coordination of it. And plus he wasn't a huge bulky guy, but he was a big man, you know, 6'3", 215, maybe something like that.
Such a wonderful athlete, man. Yeah. How about the what's my name fight? He fought a dude right after he changed his name to Muhammad Ali. It might have been Floyd Patterson, but I could be getting that wrong. And I'm not going to look because I don't want to break up the flow of the program. but he fought a guy, and the guy in the press conference kept calling him Cassius Clay. And obviously it pissed Ali off, such that when he got in the ring, he kept this guy on his feet and just gave him a savage beating. And like, you could hear Ali like through the mouthpiece, like calling out like, what's my name, mother, you know?
Yeah.
And he's just keeping this guy up to just carve him up and abuse him, because the guy wouldn't call him by his right name, which I think is a fascinating boxing story in general.
Well, yeah, I mean, Ali, I read Jonathan Eig's biography of him, very complex, controversial person, hard to say positively, negatively. Yeah, just the mouth on him.
Yeah.
It was, I mean, he probably the best trash talker in history.
Dude, you got to call him the best trash talker in history. And I think it's because he invented the genre. You know what I mean? He really like invented it, brought it into the mainstream, made it a thing. And I'm sure it went on before, but I think he really like brought it into the light, and he was great at it. And being a great trash talker, this could be its own topic, Pipe. We gotta keep a running list of these topics. But like, what makes a person a great trash talker? I think that deserves its own segment, because it's a mix of cleverness and what the guy looks like, and there's a whole like, you know, bouquet of ingredients that go into what makes a good trash talker. So we should. Do you think we should cue that up for the next episode?
Well, I'm writing it. I'm adding it to our list right now. I don't want to forget these things. So it certainly won't be forgotten, whether or not it makes the next episode or a future one. It's a great topic. Yeah, ranking past great trash talkers, and then what made them great.
What made them great and great past trash talkers. And then we've got coolest looking 90s NBA black guys and white guys.
Yep.
Which will be a fascinating and riveting discussion for a future episode. Pipe, this has been fun, man. I've enjoyed every moment of this. So we've covered a lot of like retro sports ground here this afternoon. This in ever so quickly here at the back part of the show is a book recommendation, sports book recommendation. So I'm going to let you go first on this one. Why don't you lay one on us?
Yeah, I think I'm going to go with it, given the time of year and my mention of wanting to visit Ebbets Field. I'm going to go with The Boys of Summer.
Ooh.
By Roger Kahn.
That's a classic.
Which, yeah, it is one of the classic baseball books. It's the first half of it, especially sort of his memoir of growing up in the shadow of Ebbets Field and being a, like, literally, you know, the knot hole sports fan, where he's like peeking through the fence, or they would climb up on a fire escape to catch a portion of the game. I mean, it's so quintessential nostalgic baseball. But then he goes into this thing where he tracks down all of those guys from that 40s and 50s era Dodgers team and interviews them later in life. So it's nice. Sort of a retrospective. He's a brilliant writer, great storyteller, if you're a baseball fan. So Boys of Summer by Roger Kahn is one of the best. It's fantastic.
Dude, I dig it, man. I'm going to lay one on you, too. This is another NBA book, so I'm holding off on my baseball recommendations for a few more weeks, because I know we'll have a lot of season to fill there. But one that's a favorite of mine, it's called The Breaks of the Game by David Halberstam.
Yep.
So, I mean, classic, legendary sports writer, so a champion of the craft. This one is really – it's really not – nowish in terms of how it's written. So it's not about Halberstam's cleverness. It's really kind of documentarian. So he just follows the Portland Trailblazers through a season and kind of reports on everything that he sees. And in doing so, you get some, you know, some background and some stories of specific guys, but it's really an interesting picture of what life in the NBA looked like. I think it was late 70s. So late 70s NBA life.
Was it their championship season?
You know, I don't remember, actually. It's been a few years since I've read it, and I don't think it was. I actually think it was when they had Bill Walton, but he was hurt. So there was a lot of kind of like hurt Bill Walton stuff in it. And like replacing Bill Walton kind of narratives in it. But yeah, it was really interesting, really, really well done. And it's one of those NBA books that I think has stood the test of time for sure.
And Halberstam's an author who you have to read if you're a sports fan, because of like he was a quintessential sports writer for an era, you know?
Yeah.
So it wasn't back to like, it wasn't the super historical kind of writing, you know, from like the 30s and 40s, but like there was a distinct style of the Halberstam era, and he was, you know, he was one of the best at it.
Oh, most definitely, man, for sure. And I love kind of taking a walk down memory lane into some of those classic old sports writers to see not only like what's changed, but what worked back then, you know, and what people were loving back then. And I do appreciate in a weird way, I appreciate the lack of cleverness, you know, how every piece wasn't a showcase for their own wit. It was more just, you know, a showcase for really great reporting or really great sentences or whatever the case may be. But I do enjoy it. And I think it's safe to say we've wandered to and fro throughout this episode. So until next time, Tyreek the Held Evans.
The Happy Rant is brought to you by Resonate Recordings. If you go to resonaterecordings.com, you can see the full range of services they offer. So if you're considering starting a podcast, they are the ones we recommend going with. Again, go to resonaterecordings.com to see their prices, to connect with them and ask any questions, and to see what they can do to help you launch, edit, master, and improve your podcast. Again, go to resonaterecordings.com to see what they can do to help you launch and improve your podcast.
Finding uplifting news in today's headlines is often like searching for a needle in a haystack. At the Story Behind podcast, we believe in the power of finding heartwarming tales and are happy to share empowering stories with you every week. Hear about how Steve Harvey surprised a dying man on Family Feud with $25,000. Get inspired by the note a waitress received from a patron dining alone. And even hear about how one VIP passenger made a hardworking pilot get emotional before his flight. To start listening to the Story Behind podcast, visit lifeaudio.com or search Story Behind on your favorite podcast platform.